Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided by Voice Republic at httpvoicerepublic.com.
You're listening to Back to Us Radio on the Back to Us Network.
Today's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/backtous. That is audiblepodcast.com/BACK, the number 2, US.
Oh my gosh, you are not going to believe what they are talking about on the Strong Stance.
Good evening, Strong Stance listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Strong Stance. I'm your host, Eli Strong, and we have got an amazing show for you tonight. It is not only amazing because of the wealth of information that we will be talking about and the guests we have. From on a personal note, it is my first broadcast from my new home in Washington, Georgia. But the topic that we're going to be talking about tonight is one of paramount importance. And we talk about a lot of topics on this show that are of importance, and this one, I have to say, ranks right up there among the top few because of the fact that it affects so much of the transgender community. And tonight we're going to be talking about transgender wellness, access to culturally competent and comprehensive care. And access to healthcare has lately been a hotly debated topic, both inside and outside of the transgender and genderqueer community. What's covered, what's not, who's covered and who's not. It's a discussion that cuts across class, race, sex, gender identity, and now with the Affordable Care Act, there's even more debate and discussion. And a good number of these decisions particularly affect the trans community. And tonight we're going to discuss the current climate of healthcare as it relates to the trans and genderqueer community and the access and or hurdles to competent and comprehensive care for our community. And in order to do that, we have an amazing guest tonight. Our guest is Danielle Aschini, who is the current policy director at Basic Rights Oregon. Danielle joined Basic Rights Oregon from Seattle, Washington, where she was the founding executive director of Gender Justice League, a trans activist collective, where she worked to repeal trans health insurance exclusions in Washington, launch Trans Pride Seattle, the largest trans event in the Pacific Northwest, and mobilizing to include trans people in HIV prevention and testing efforts in Washington State. Danielle's background and activism is varied both by subject matter as well as geography. For 3 years, she served as the National Program Manager at Gay Straight Alliance Network in San Francisco, working with GSAs in over 32 states. She created the first trans health clinic in Seattle at Verbena Health from 2006 to 2008 and worked extensively in New England as a policy wonk queer activist at the Center for Preventing Hate Violence, the Muskie Institute for Public Policy, on behalf of other foster youth and at Outright Portland as a queer youth activist. Danielle also has strong roots in both Sweden and the Netherlands, where she worked as a trans activist to increase access to trans health in a depathologized and decentralized way with her colleagues at RFSL. Danielle splits her time between Portland and Seattle, where her brother, sister, and partner are holed up in the last Scandinavian bastion of the Pacific Northwest, Ballard. And so I'm sure that as our listeners might have heard the words here several times in that bio, we are in good hands tonight while we discuss some of these issues. So Danielle, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much, Eli, for having me on.
Absolutely. So, you know, I feel like I kind of lucked out in being introduced to you virtually as it was, because I've read through your bio, I've done a little research on you, and you are amazingly well versed in not just, you know, trans activism in general, but particularly with trans healthcare. And before we jump into that, though, I'd really like to know what, just for a little background for those of our listeners that don't know anything about Basic Rights Oregon, what really does Basic Rights Oregon do?
Sure. So Basic Rights Oregon is a statewide LGBT advocacy organization that is working to build a politically powerful movement for LGBT people in Oregon. And so we do a wide array of work. We are working to elect progressive candidates. We're working to pass ballot measures that support our community. So right now we're working on a ballot measure called Measure 88, which is Safe Roads, which would give driver cards to people who are undocumented. And we have both a trans justice and racial justice program. The trans justice program is focused on things like increasing access to health care by repealing exclusions, holding insurance companies accountable. We're working on prison and jail policies, and we're working to ensure that people, trans people in Oregon, experience lived equality by implementing the good policies that we've passed, such as our state non-discrimination law. The Racial Justice Program, Racial Justice and Alliance Building Program, is doing really incredible work to build and strengthen the leadership of queer trans people of color and to elevate that leadership into a politically powerful voice to support things like Measure 88 and to do more leadership development. So that's a little bit about what Basic Rights Oregon does.
That's awesome. And, you know, one of the things that I was really intrigued in your bio about was that you are also the founding executive director of Gender Justice League. And I was wondering if you could also kind of give our listeners a little flavor for what exactly the Gender Justice League is and does.
Sure, and I'm about to return back from Basic Rights Oregon to Gender Justice League to continue being their executive director. So Gender Justice League is a trans... it's exciting. It's a trans activist collective that is pretty grassroots and that is focused primarily, similar to Basic Rights Oregon, on advocacy around removing health insurance exclusions, increasing access and visibility of trans folks in HIV prevention education, creating more community visibility and community events and space through the creation of Trans Pride Seattle and community events like Fighting Trans Misogyny. And we're doing a lot of leadership development, which we really see as being the key strategy for us to build political power for trans people, is to train and recruit more trans folks into the movement to learn how to do advocacy and to learn how to advocate for better policies.
That is a mouthful of extremely important work, and I think that's really awesome that you are going back to do that. Is it kind of like your baby? You're one of the founders, or does it feel kind of like a coming home of sorts?
It definitely does. I mean, I would say that it started with a community of friends and activists in Seattle, and it's both where my heart is and so many friends at Gender Justice League, and just the approach and the passion that I've experienced there. I feel so deeply connected to that work and that community.
Well, so before we really kind of dive into some of the healthcare issues that I know that you are so amazingly well versed in, one of the things that I thought that maybe we could first discuss is the fact that, you know, when it comes to access to healthcare, lots of people have problems with access to healthcare. And I think that one of the things that affects the trans community at such a high level when it comes to that access is that intersectionality of otherness, right? Like most of the time as trans people, we also have to face, you know, not only the cis sexism, but often there is, you know, difficulty finding and maintaining a job, whether it be due to bigotry or due to whatever the case may be. So there is often an issue of poverty and an issue of classism. If, you know, oftentimes many trans people are the recipient of a great amount of homophobia, whether or not they identify as LG or B, simply because there's a lot of misinformation out there about who trans people are, and so homophobia kind of bleeds into that trans spectrum as well. And so straight, gay, lesbian, bisexual, pansexual, you know, asexual, all types of trans people tend to experience a little bit of homophobia. And, you know, with all those things kind of pulled together, I wonder if you could just kind of talk about some of the ways in which that can really compound itself to make access to healthcare all that more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you absolutely highlight some of the key challenges that we face in the community, which is not only just a lack of the basic knowledge about providing trans-specific healthcare, right, which there's a huge lack of knowledge, and there's actually only, that I know of, two elective courses in medical schools in the United States, one that I co-teach at University of Washington and another at University of California, San Francisco, that focus specifically on talking about providing culturally competent trans care. So just that basic knowledge is so lacking and not included in medical schools or nursing school or social work school curriculums. But also, like you said, the level of discrimination is so high. I believe the number from the National Transgender Discrimination Survey is that 1 in 5 trans people have been refused care just based on who they are. And that is so alarming, especially as somebody like myself who's lived with chronic illnesses and disability, to know that, you know, my chances are basically 1 in 5 of being rejected from receiving basic care just based on who I am. So I definitely see this as like there's really 3 key problems. One is increasing the comfort and cultural competence of providers to just provide any other type of care. 2 is providing trans-specific culturally competent care. And 3 is repealing health insurance exclusions that prevent us from getting the care that we need and being treated like human beings and everybody else is treated, and gaining access to basically the same health care that cis people get without any question.
Right, right. And you know, you bring up the topic of 1 in 5 that are rejected simply because of who they are. Can you talk a little bit about some of the that whole idea of being trans as being a pre-existing condition, you know, not so much when it comes to dealing with medical professionals, but when we're talking about dealing with access to healthcare coverage and insurance, whether, you know, that be private insurance or, you know, whether it's private payers or Medicare or Medicaid or whatever the case may be, the idea of trans being a pre-existing condition and an insurance company's, well, maybe not anymore, but an insurance company's quote-unquote right to refuse all claims with regard to a trans person's treatment under the guise of, well, we don't cover transition.
Yeah. So there's kind of, I think there's 2 things that are there. One is the idea of gender dysphoria, which is the diagnosis from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders that
right.
trans folks are labeled with. I think that is, has in the past been used as a weapon, basically, to deny trans people access to care by saying, hey, it's a pre-existing condition, we don't cover it. The Affordable Care Act did away with pre-existing condition exclusions, which is really incredible. And so folks in every state across the country should not be encountering denials on the basis of a pre-existing condition. But it didn't necessarily open up access to care, removing that. So the other thing is that a lot of almost all health insurance policies in this country, except for 6 states, or I guess technically 5 states in the District of Columbia, have these categorical exclusions in health plans that say this plan does not cover gender transition-related services, hormones, or surgeries. Or, you know, there's a bunch of different types of boilerplate language that you find in policies with these categorical exclusions. States that have a state non-discrimination law have been more successful at getting insurance commissioners to issue bulletins saying, hey, the state non-discrimination law applies to insurance, and that means if you're providing care to cisgender people, such as hormones or surgeries, you have to provide that same care to trans people. And that gets us about 90% of the way to the care that we want
right.
or need. There are obviously some surgeries that trans people undergo that cis people don't undergo. And we've definitely had problems in Oregon, less so in Washington, because our insurance bulletin has just gone into effect. But in Oregon, we've definitely had trouble still getting insurers to implement these bulletins. But that's kind of a little bit about sort of the health insurance exclusions, and the strategy and tactic has been to get insurance commissioners to issue memos saying, hey, you cannot discriminate.
Right. Now, do you find in the work that you do, because I'm sure that you are privy to a lot of stories, right? People, you know, giving over their stories to you guys about, you know, this is what happened to me. These are the times that I've had problems when trying to access health care. Do you find that even in those states that have those bulletins, right, that insurance companies will try to find a way around it by putting up more roadblocks?
Absolutely. So what we found in Oregon is that insurance companies have stopped having categorical exclusions in their policies, but that when trans folks try to access, like, chest reconstruction, for instance, they will say, well, we don't deem that as being medically necessary. We don't think that chest reconstruction is a medically necessary service. And so what we've had to do is do community education, and we're about to have a forum on Saturday of this week to do this, to help people file appeals with the insurer themselves, saying, actually, this is medically necessary surgery on the WPATH standards of care for the treatment of a diagnosis, which is gender dysphoria. Basically, we have to spell it out for them, like, you have to cover this. It is medically necessary. And then filing appeals with the insurer, and then filing a complaint and an appeal with the insurance division within at least Oregon. And in Washington is the other key piece to sort of hold these insurance companies accountable for providing the care that they are legally required to do. So it's continued to be a struggle. We just have found a new way to deny people access by saying, oh, well, this care isn't medically necessary.
Yeah, and on a personal note, to be quite frank, one of the ways that I kind of saw this start to play out was that when this came out in D.C., you know, one of the things that I did was I went to the clinic where I was getting all of my injectable testosterone. And first, what I did was I went to my company, my employer, HR, the benefits person, and said, here's the deal, here's the posting, here's what it says, can you look into this? And basically what our insurance company said, even though I know full well that there are other people that are on that policy that do not have to do this with other injectables, is that they said it would only cover injectables if the doctor wrote a letter to the insurance company stating why it was medically necessary, and that every injection had to be administered on site at the doctor's office in order for them to cover my medication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are insurance companies.
Point where I was like, yeah, this isn't worth it. So I'm just, it was cheap enough because of where I was going. Whit Walker does a wonderful job in making sure people have access to the medication that they often can't afford. And so I was like, this isn't worth it. It would cost me more money to pay a copay every time and to take time off work every time to go to the clinic. I'll just keep paying for it out of my pocket.
Yeah. And I think that that's the story of insurance in America for everybody across most, unfortunately, most illnesses, is that, you know, they try to put up barriers to discourage people from utilizing insurance. And I think particularly for the trans community where we've been targeted and denied for so long, people are very quick to just give up and to say, this is too much of a hassle, I'm just going to pay out of pocket. And that's what insurance companies want. And I think one of the things that we have to, or I think I'm trying to instill in other folks as a community, is to, like, stand up and say, no, actually, even though I'm going to pay for this out of pocket, I'm still going to file a grievance. I'm still going to file an appeal. Because what it means is that later on down the road for other trans folks who maybe don't have the wherewithal to file an appeal and go through that, you know, boring and long process, that it creates inroads for other people in the future and really keeps and holds the insurance companies accountable. But they are so creative about finding all kinds of exclusions. One of the other things that I've heard recently is that they say, oh, well, hormones are an off-label use for gender transition, and so because it's not in such and such compendium of pharmacopoeia or pharmacology, we're not going to cover it for off-label use. Well, we've had success in helping people file an appeal to that insurance company denial, and we were successful in that person being able to get their hormones covered. And so it's really like the appeals process, unfortunately, is kind of the only way that an external third party gets involved and can say, actually, no, you have to cover this care.
Okay. You know, it's important to know that, you know, for, you know, have that ability to stand up and kind of, like you said, be able to file that claim that they should do so. I consider myself one of those people. I was not willing to fight. I was like, I'm picking one to not fight, always saying I should commit to it. It's one of those things where it's good to remember that it's not just about can you afford it or can you not, that it does affect other people. So thank you for kind of, you know, explaining that, you know, not only, again, to me, but also for those listening. So you mentioned that ACA, Affordable Care Act, has taken away the idea of pre-existing conditions and being denied care based on pre-existing conditions. Are there other ways in ACA has changed some of the regulations that specifically tend to affects trans people. You know, taking into consideration gender identity, socioeconomic status, employment, all that kind of stuff. Are there other ways the ACA has changed some regulations for the better, or for not the better, for the trans community?
Sure. I would say overall the Affordable Care Act has been an incredible, benefit and hugely strengthen the trans community's access to both basic health care and, I'm hoping in the future, more so transition-related health care. So a good example is that the expansion in many states, and not every state has expanded Medicaid, the expansion of Medicaid, which is the health insurance program for low-income people in this country, has really benefited trans folks who we know are four times more likely to live in poverty in the United States, are four times more likely to be low income. Having access to Medicaid has been essential. And in both Oregon and Washington, we've been successful in getting coverage for transition-related health care in Medicaid in the low-income health program. And my hope is that that will start to spread, and we'll be producing toolkits to help other advocates know how to file appeals, how to work with their state Medicaid programs to require them to cover medically necessary care. And so the Affordable Care Act adds a couple provisions that I think will be useful tools for our advocacy efforts in the future. And those are, it expanded the Mental Health Care Parity Act, which says that mental health conditions have to be covered at parity with physical health conditions. And gender dysphoria is considered a mental health condition. The treatment for gender dysphoria, which is therapy, doctor's visits, hormones, and surgery, those treatments have to be covered on parity as any other coverage that an insurer would provide for the treatment of a physical disease, like, say, I have Parkinson's disease, so say Parkinson's disease. And so that is a really boon. And then also there is a prohibition against sex-based discrimination, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has said that they interpret that to mean a person's actual or perceived gender identity. And so they wrote a letter to the National Center for Lesbian Rights that explained that there are prohibitions that should protect trans people in getting access to care. Those rules haven't been finalized yet, and this is the thing about federal legislation. It takes them forever to write the final rules. But we're really hopeful that those final rules will have really explicit protections for trans people. So those are two things that the three things the Affordable Care Act has done that has really been amazing for trans folks.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I feel like even though I am someone of, I mean, not a lot of means, but some means and enough to have, you know, healthcare through my employer, that even though that is the case, with ACA, I felt like there was a greater coverage for things. I felt like I could basically not have to worry so much about my health care going forward. And it absolutely, I've talked to people who it's really kind of changed, you know, their perspective on their outlook on their health in the future, and they're not necessarily as worried about it. Like, there were people that I knew that were, you know, spending a ton of time in therapist's office, you know, for many of the different stressors that we have, but a good chunk of it is about their physical health and the ability and the access to health care that is going to be, you know, as we said, culturally competent and comprehensive. So I think that it has done a world of good, particularly for our community. So explain something to me. You know, Medicaid and Medicare, not necessarily directly related to private payer insurance, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there is a correlation there, right? There, mm-hmm. There's something to be said about if something goes through for Medicaid or Medicare, what does that say for the road of the private insurance? What is that relationship? What is it that makes that bond between the two kind of... Why is it that people that aren't on Medicaid should still stand up and listen and pay attention to what's happening within Medicaid and within Medicare? How does that affect other people?
Absolutely. So I would say Medicare, which is the federally administered health insurance program for folks over 65, Medicare recently repealed a rule that had an exclusion that had existed on really junk science since the early 1980s. they expand, they removed that rule, and they have yet to replace it with a clear line around what will be covered exactly. What we've seen is that Medicare folks have now been able to access transition-related surgeries and hormones and doctor's visits through Medicare. And so folks should know that Medicare now covers transition-related health care. And, you know, there's going to be hiccups along the way. It's the largest health insurer in the country. And if folks are trying to access care, they might have some difficulty, but definitely get in touch with, you know, the 1-800-Medicare number. And so coverage has expanded. What that means is that Medicare tends to, because it's the largest single payer in the country of health in, of health coverage, it tends to set the bar of what is expected to be covered for other health insurance. And so the success of advocates, many other folks like at National Center for Transgender Equality and the Task Force and Lambda Legal and GLAAD 1A in Boston, their success in repealing that exclusion has been monumental. And so that has really will translate, I think, to mean that other advocates in other states will be able to point to that and say, listen, everybody needs to be covering this very basic health care. If Medicare is covering it, then my private health insurance should. And Medicaid, you know, it's a state-administered program, so the rules of what is covered are set state to state, and everything is different in how they determine what is covered. And it's a little bit trickier to get coverage there because of politics, right? Like the people who are appointed to the board to make the determination about what is covered. But I really think that this narrative of the expansion of all of these coverages, there is a strong argument that we've made both in Oregon and Washington successfully that this care is medically necessary and life-saving. We know that 40% of transgender people will attempt suicide at some point in their life based off the National Center for Transgender Equality study, based off of other research data, and making the argument that this is life-saving care that we know from research that access to transition-related health care reduces suicide rates down to about the average for the general population, that is so vital and important, an argument to be able to make that we've had a lot of success in convincing policymakers here in the Northwest, and California, Vermont have also had success in that regard. I think that that's the future of where things are headed.
It's one of those things where people ask me that a lot when I say, oh, yeah, did you hear about such and such? They're like, yeah, but I'm not on Medicare. What do I care? I'm like, well, but you're on Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they're probably going to do what Medicare eventually does if they haven't, you know, immediately taken note. They will. So are there any glaring or not so glaring gaps that are still left after ACA has now been passed? Like what are some of the gaps that are still need to be patched that ACA, you know, ACA, like you said, it's done so many great things for our community. Not only our community, but specifically our community. But what are some of the gaps that are still left after the dust now has settled with the Affordable Care Act?
Sure. So I think that there's sort of beyond the Affordable Care Act, we really have to, unfortunately, go state by state to get coverage. Much like we saw with marriage equality, it's unfortunately an issue that health insurance is regulated state by state, and so that means that we're going to have a period of time where some states have coverage, health insurance coverage, and other states do not. And so it will unfortunately be a piecemeal approach where it's going to be advocating with every insurance commissioner, with every state Medicaid program to sort of get these coverages rolled out. I think that's one challenge, is like to actually just go case by case. And then in states where we get bulletins, we have to work really diligently to educate our own community about filing appeals and enforcing the bulletins and enforcing the law and holding the insurance companies accountable for these gains that we've made. That really takes sort of a community-wide effort to support each other in advocacy, because it's really draining to have to file an appeal and to have to be told you have to wait for the appeal to go through in order to get, you know, access to the surgery or hormones that you need. That's really frustrating. And then I think the other gap is on the other end, which is actually with increased insurance coverage like Medicare and Medicaid and private health insurance, like all of a sudden we're going to be in a brave new world of not having enough surgical providers to provide the care for the number, the huge number of trans people that have been waiting to gain access to surgical care. There's just not enough skilled physicians and surgeons to provide that care now that it's going to be covered under insurance. So that's the other piece, like, that we've started at Gender Justice League and University of Washington. I know Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland is working on this, which is to train and encourage plastic surgery programs and reconstructive surgery programs to train their physicians to learn how to do surgical procedures for trans folks and to really try to work with the medical community to build out programs to build the number of skilled surgeons in this country who can perform transition-related surgical health care. And, you know, the American College of Family Practitioners and Primary Care Doctors, to get them to create modules of transcultural competence and just basic primary health care education. So I think that that's the other sort of future work, is making this, I think health insurance coverage will lead to an opportunity and a moment where people will stand up and take notice, and it will move into the mainstream, hopefully, of this care is considered basic health care that all doctors should know how to do. Really, hormonal health care, for the most part, is not rocket science. And most primary care doctors can do it, and they already are doing it for people with other hormone disorders. And so I think that that's the future, is that hopefully we're able to, as a community, work with advocates, work with physicians to build out those modules of education and spread the knowledge and spread the training and spread the skills for talented surgeons now that we're going to be gaining access to insurance benefits. I fear a little bit that there's going to be a bottleneck where there's too few providers and tons of people trying to get access to care.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because, I mean, it's obviously, it's spot on that, you know, insurance, I would say I kind of consider it a little bit more than half the battle, but it's like, even once you have insurance, you have coverage for your trans-related care, because maybe you live in one of the states where they are, you know, adequately and proactively infecting those persons. And the question is, even guarantee you finding a physician that will not only treat you as a trans person, but even those that they mean well and they're inclusive of who they accept as patients, there's no guarantee that a physician will be competent to treat you as a trans person, particularly during a pandemic. I'm not talking about I'm not talking about a doctor that doesn't know how to treat a cold or a flu or a broken arm just because you're trans. Obviously, you know, people are people. Those things happen to everybody. I'm talking about, like, what you were just talking about. There's no guarantee that this person is going to be even remotely trained in how to administer hormones, even though it is a relatively simple, you know, process, or would be willing to learn, or the surgical, you know, aspect of everything. And so, I mean, I agree. I hate to see that bottleneck. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, yay, at least that's part of it, that there are so many people that now have the ability to, but now it's actually gaining that access via the physician. You know, you mentioned the couple of different, I think you said two different classes that teach, you know, culturally competent transition-related care for trans people, and you mentioned a couple of different programs that kind of help out with that. Are you a regular attendee? What are your feelings on Philly Trans Health? Is it something that you think that physicians should attend? Do you find that they learn a lot from it? Has the community kind of, I'm not going to say outgrown it, like I've heard a lot of people say, every time I go, it's all the 101 stuff that maybe is great for physicians, but I feel like we need people to go further. Like, how do you feel about the role that Philly Trans Health plays in doing some of this offhanded education that we are going to need so much in order to resolve this bottleneck that you're foreseeing?
Yeah, I mean, I've been going to Philly Trans Health Conference actually since the very first one, and I haven't gone to every one, but I've definitely, I think the last one I went to was actually maybe it was even last year, and I think that it definitely plays a crucial role in bringing the community together to talk about health and wellness beyond sort of the very fundamentals of, like, hormone-related healthcare, right? Like, that's even the most basic level of healthcare, but there's so many other, like, health and wellness issues that trans folks face. I think it's a really powerful place to bring the community together and to bring providers together to be focused on this broad array of health and wellness in a really big picture sense. And I think that that is super incredibly powerful. I think that space, and I know that like Gender Odyssey serves some of that here on the West Coast in Seattle, and there's like Gold Rush in Colorado and Southern Comfort in the South. I think it's moving to Florida now. I think the conferences play a crucial role in convening folks to have conversations and to be able to share with each other and sort of share collectively. And certainly I gained a lot of knowledge from listening to lecturers, meeting surgeons, meeting doctors who are providing incredible care, networking with people who I then have called upon in my advocacy efforts. And so I think they serve as such vital spaces, and we need to really support and maintain them as much as, you know, the 101 might feel tedious for folks who've been out for 15 or 20 years. The reality is that there are new folks coming out all the time, and those are really vital.
Right.
But I do think that there's this higher level of creating a professional medical school curriculum that is portable, that is comprehensive, that is available. And I know Vancouver Coastal Health Project used to have really incredible guidelines. They recently took them offline, unfortunately. I don't know why, but they might be revising them right now. But they have these really incredible guidelines that I relied upon heavily to do education in primary care settings with, you know, free clinics in the Puget Sound region or working with the VA hospital in Seattle and in Portland. And so I think having more guidelines like that, more curriculum that's really clearly tailored and instructional is helpful. But one of the biggest barriers is fear. And what I see a lot of in primary care providers is just a fear of the unknown. Like, I don't know how to do this. Yeah. I've never done it before. And it is tied with cultural sexism and transphobia, that it's not a malicious type of fear around, like, I don't want to serve trans people. A lot of people are in this nebulous region of, like, I'm willing to, I don't know how to. It's like the confidence isn't there. And I like to think of trying to build two things, the confidence, the knowledge, the skills, the, like, what you do as a doctor to provide this healthcare, but also the confidence, like, creating a network to support providers, connecting them to other providers who've done this care for longer, making sure that they have a mentor that they can call with us. Hey, I saw this trans person and we're having this challenge together. What do you think? Am I following the right path here? You know, so they don't feel like they're going off into the great unknown on their own. I think that the confidence piece is another component as advocates are doing this work to think about. It's not just getting them the skills and knowledge and behaviors and beliefs. It's also getting them connected to feeling confident to do the care. That is just as vital a piece that we have to build in people.
Yeah, and, you know, because I just moved from a region that had such a high number of relatively, you know, let's say a relatively high number of competent physicians when it came to transgender health, what was very heartening for me is that my, you know, physician told me flat out, said, when you find a doctor down there, if they are unaware or if they are unsure or if they are all trepidatious about this, I am happy for you to give them my number and let them call me and talk to me, especially considering, you know, I'm not early in my transition. Mine is mostly maintenance, right? But it's really important, not only, like you're saying, to build that network, but for the physicians that are willing and are competent to kind of maintain that give back attitude, right? Like all physicians and most people in healthcare industry have to go through a course of like continuing education. You have to have a certain number of, you know, whatever, every year you got to continue that education, you know, and so it's important that there be that kind of even relaxed, less formal atmosphere for physicians to be able to talk to each other. You know, I never even thought about that, right? It never even crossed my mind to ask her, hey, would you mind if my new doctor, whoever that may be, gave you a call? But she was more than willing to go ahead and offer that information. And so I would hope that we could, if there was a network that would reach out to those who are looking for a little guidance or a little bit of backup, and just go, hey, we've all been there. I had to learn it. You're learning it. It's cool. Call me with a problem. You know what I mean? And so, you know, I absolutely agree. Do you know if either does Basic Rights Oregon or Gender Justice League or anywhere else, either in that area or a national organization, is there some kind of coalition of medical professionals that one could say, like, does Basic Rights Oregon have a list of here are the doctors that you can go to and know that you are not walking into an office where they've never seen the trans person before and they know how to actually treat someone through a medical transition or just basic maintenance or whatever the case may be? Like, is there a resource out there other than just a larger LGBT network of physicians? Is there one specific for the trans community?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different resources that I usually point people at, which is WPATH obviously maintains a list of providers who are signed up and are culturally competent and are members of WPATH. And so the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, they also provide a lot of training and education and connect physicians with each other. And so they maintain a listserv where people can ask questions, and it's very active. I know that WPATH is really like one resource that in the past has not been the greatest, but that is sort of their role and is increasingly has had trans folks more and more involved in leadership there, which I think is helpful. In Portland, we have resources PDX, which is a website maintained by Q Center, which is our LGBT community center. And they're working, we're Basic Rights Oregon is working with Q Center to build a list of culturally competent providers, particularly with an emphasis on Oregon Health Plan, which is our state Medicaid program, because lots of folks have difficulty finding Medicaid providers, folks who take Medicaid and who are culturally competent. So that's a resource. And then I know that recently, like, TransHack, which is this incredible sort of, like, national event that goes around the country. I think they're about to have one at Harvard. They've had one in Chicago, in L.A. TransHack had one of the trans hackathon winners, I think the Chicago one, were folks that are working on putting together a national database that is going to hopefully, and they've connected to folks at Gender Justice League and at BRO. Riley, I can't remember Riley's last name, but Riley is like one of the lead people on that and is really working to build that sort of national database in a way that is like folks can report like, hey, I live in Washington, Georgia, and here's who my provider is, and they're pretty good, so that other folks can have access to that information. So I think it's a really exciting time that we're going to be able to hopefully have like a cloud-based and crowdsourced directory that trans folks have designed the software, the website and the software that's behind that. So I'm really excited for that project moving forward. And in Seattle, we have Ingersoll Gender Center helps, which is our support group and support organization. They have a consultancy group of therapists and doctors who meet every other month on the third Tuesday of the month to discuss regularly what's going on. We put together a King County resource guide in Seattle, and there's also a gender roundtable that we have been having, which is service providers coming together once a quarter to kind of share, discuss, talk, meet each other, learn about each other's services so that we can coordinate all of the different stuff that's going on to serve trans people in Seattle. So those are some of the things that are going on nationally and locally.
That's awesome. So last little, you know, topic that I'd love to get your opinion on, get your weigh in on before we kind of start to kind of recap and all of that is that, you know, you have had a wealth of experience in this country and other countries with regard to the United States. Can you kind of discuss maybe, or even if it's just list, maybe some of the best and worst places to live as a trans person with regard to healthcare, right? The hardest places to get access, the best places to get access, not to really put anybody down, but just to show folks these are the areas where we need the most work. Obviously, we need work everywhere, but these are the areas we need the most work. These are the areas where, you know, those other areas maybe should look to these other, you know, states to see how it's being done. And then maybe talk about where does Oregon and or Washington State fall in that realm of the good and bad places to live with regard to trans access to competent and comprehensive health care.
Sure. So I would say that across the board, there's difficulties no matter where you are, including in Seattle or Portland, in accessing health care for a lot of different reasons. You know, the general health care system in America is broken desperately, and certainly for trans folks, that's doubly so. I would say that there are states where things are getting better, where they're improving. So the states that have Medicaid coverage that covers transition, Medicaid is the state low-income program, so folks are low-income. Those states include Massachusetts, Vermont, Washington, D.C., which isn't a state, but it should be, California, Oregon, and Washington as of January. And so really the Northeast and the West Coast are the states that have coverage right now for Medicaid. There are several states that have insurance bulletins for private insurance, and those include Colorado, California, Oregon, Washington, Connecticut, Vermont, I believe, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C. And so those states have insurance bulletins for private insurance. And then all across the country is Medicare. I would say that the West Coast and the Northeast are definitely far better in terms of access to culturally competent care, the number of providers who are available, and the likelihood that you will have an insurance policy that covers your care.
Okay. Well, I got to tell you, this has just been, as I promised our listeners at the beginning, a wealth of information, and it's been really great to talk to you. This is just, it's something that I kind of, it's one of the things that I try to stay as up on as I possibly can. You know, there's a lot of issues in our community. I feel like healthcare is such a big one because I feel like that even for people of means, it's one of the first things that we let, as human beings, it tends to be one of the first things we let slip when money starts to get tight, right? We pay the rent or the mortgage first. We pay our bills first. We neglect the cold. We neglect our preventative health care that can, you know, solve so many problems before they start. Not all, obviously. But I just think that as a nation, and maybe even as a human population, we tend to put our own health last, and it is just of critical importance that we take care of ourselves. There's sometimes a big, beautiful world, but sometimes that world can be kind of ugly and beat up on us a lot. And so I feel like, you know, being able to take control of your health care, being able to take control of, you know, the people that you interact with in that healthcare and being able to afford it are just some of the most important things that whether you have money to do it or not that we take for granted. I mean, I could be wrong. That's my personal opinion. And so I very much appreciate you kind of coming on and trying to make this as palatable as possible because healthcare can be such a large grisly beast to kind of unravel. And so I really appreciate all the insight that you've been able to give. One of the things that I always like to do towards the end of the show is plugs. And I would love for, you know, you've said a lot of wonderful things about all the great work that Basic Rights Oregon does and that Gender Justice League does. And so I want to, you know, ask you if you would please give any kind of, you know, contact information, whether it's social media or websites or phone numbers or whatever it is, for those groups, for other groups that you feel that people in that area, in your area of the country, can reach out and find folks or find information, whether it's about healthcare or other resources within the trans community. So if you could tell our listeners, how can they get in touch with Basic Rights Oregon, whether it's to volunteer or whatever, and Gender Justice League as well?
Sure, yeah. So I would say Basic Rights Oregon's website is just basicrights.org. And if you go to our website, you'll see the Trans Justice Program, which has tons of posts just about frequently asked questions about Oregon Health Plan, about the private health insurance bulletin, information about our upcoming campaigns and advocacy work that we're doing. So that's www.basicrights.org. And we do regular volunteer orientation trainings. We have lots of community events going on all the time. And so folks are definitely, if you're African or you're visiting, give us a shout out. We'd love to be connected to you. Gender Justice League is, again, it's just genderjusticeleague.org in Seattle. In Gender Justice League, similarly, we have regular membership meetings every month. We're more of a collective and membership-focused organization. And so we sort of do all of our projects together as one big team. And it's a really fun, connected, deep community that's working together in Seattle. And then I would be remiss if I didn't mention CAP, which is the Center for American Progress. And so CAP has a whole program around transgender healthcare policy nationally, and Callan Baker is one of the key people that's working there at CAP. My good friend Andrew Cray, who recently passed away, unfortunately, was an amazing and incredible advocate who did so much work around the Affordable Care Act, also worked at CAP, and his legacy is continued very strong there. And so much of his incredible brilliance and writing and toolkits for trans folks to understand how to get enrolled in healthcare is all available on CAP's website. So I think that's Center for American Progress, and you'll have to Google that. I don't know what their website off the top of my head, but Center for American Progress. And then, of course, National Center for Transgender Equality, Lisa Moté, Harper, Jean, amazing folks at National Center for Transgender Equality, who are also an incredible resource for folks who have questions about healthcare. And of course, folks are welcome to get in touch with me. My email is just Danielle, Danielle, at genderjusticeleague.org. And I'm happy to talk to folks about advocacy strategies, about what's going on in their state, about some of the strategies that we've used in Oregon and Washington, if they're interested, about, how to form a community coalition to get some of these exclusions repealed. I'm happy to talk to folks. It's my favorite thing to geek out with people, to talk strategies, how to help increase access to care. And I'm also happy to connect folks to more resources about training doctors, about doing cultural competency education, even as just lay people, as trans folks in the community who might not have any medical or mental health background, I still think there's a huge role that trans folks can play in creating a climate to do that education.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate all of those plugs, and of course, our friends in NCTE. I'm not sure that there's more than a month or two that goes by without somebody plugging them at some point in our show. They do some amazing work. I want to thank you so much for joining me. This is one of the first times, most of the time my guests come from either, in the East or in the South. It's really great to talk to someone about what's going on the West Coast and how things are, what's the climate like out there. So I really appreciate, with everything that's going on right now in your life, both I'm sure personally and professionally, you taking the time to join us and explaining all this. And what I would like to do before we obviously thank our sponsors is I would really love to give you the floor for that kind of last word. If there's anything that you want our listeners to know, something to keep in mind, something you want them to part ways knowing, just that anything else that you'd like to impart upon them before the end of our show.
Yeah, I guess I would just say to folks who are out there listening, as somebody who transitioned really young and I lived in Maine, which is a pretty rural place, I transitioned in the late 90s. There was not a lot of resources, not a lot of trans folks, not a lot of culturally competent providers I think the message of hope that there is, things are changing and they're actually changing rapidly for the better. We're at the sort of cusp of a really remarkable culture shift in the way that trans folks are viewed and the way that we're able to access care. But a huge amount of that is really based on the incredibly hard work of so many advocates and so many allies. And so it really just takes folks that are listeners to, contribute as much as you can with your time and energy and thoughts and resources and dedication and heart and support of other folks who are doing this work, even if it's just making brownies, just reaching out to folks and listening and supporting advocates and letting them vent. One of the biggest things that folks do for me is I go to a horribly oppressive transphobic committee hearing and then just having community members be like, oh, girl, that had to be terrible. And I'm like, you have no idea.
Yes.
Because that, even just that, being supportive is so powerful in making this movement go forward to liberate us all. And so I think that's my closing word, is like, we are at a really powerful and amazing moment. And I'm just so proud of our whole community for doing this together. It's been really, I mean, for me personally, amazing and incredible to watch.
Well, thank you again for those words, and thank you for all of the knowledge that you've imparted on us. I really appreciate it, and I will absolutely be keeping in touch with you. You are an amazing wealth of knowledge, and just generally seem to be a very cool person that I would love to stay in touch with. So thanks
absolutely.
Again for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And, of course, last but certainly not least, I want to thank our sponsors, Audible.com. As with every month, I do have a book recommendation for you this month. This month, I am recommending The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Many people have read this book. I believe that Oprah at one point had recommended it. And if you go to audiblepodcast.com/back2us, and sign up for a membership to Audible.com, your first download is free. And so you could download The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime for free if this is your first book with Audible.com. We really appreciate all that Audible does for us as sponsors, and so, of course, we definitely want to thank them. Until next month, when we will have, I'm sure, another very amazingly informative and interesting topic to bring you, I hope that everyone has a very spirited month. I hope that everyone learned a little something from tonight. And I hope that you take those last words from Danielle of hope, because they're the one thing that we absolutely as a community cannot let go. As I always say, or at least I try to always say, if you need help, if you need someone, reach out. Danielle gave her email. Everyone, you know how to find me. We're on Facebook. Find us. If you need help, reach out for somebody. If you just need to talk to somebody, reach out to somebody. And until then, I hope that everyone has a wonderful month, and I will see you again next month. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Have a good night.
You have been listening to a recording provided by Voice Republic at http://voicerepublic.com.